Today is July 9th, 2016. Okay, so we can start. We do three times the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so we've been discussing sutta number 43 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Mahavedala Sutta. So this is the greatest, well, it's translated, the title is translated, the greater series of questions and answers. And as I explained last time, the exact meaning of the word Vedala, it's not really known with certainty. But if we look at this sutta and the following sutta, number 44, the Chula Vedala Sutta, we could see that both suttas take the form of a series of questions and answers. And sometimes there are sudden shifts in the topic without any apparent connection between them. So it's almost like they are miscellaneous series of questions and answers. And also, as I said last time, it seems to me that these two suttas are part of the, or mark a kind of transition phase from the age of the Nikaya, of the old portions of the Nikayas, to the emergence of the Abhidharma. They have very much an Abhidharma-like flavor to them, going into kind of like detailed, rigorous analysis of doctrinal concepts. Okay, so the last time we did the first few sections of the Mahavedala Sutta, which are concerned with distinguishing wisdom, consciousness, feeling and perception. So you could see that we have here an analysis of mental factors, which is one of the main undertakings in the Abhidharma. Okay, so now we're going to resume the sutta at section number 10. Okay, and this is the dialogue is between the Venerable Mahakotita, the monk named Mahakotita, and the Venerable Sariputta. And it's apparently it's Mahakotita who is asking the questions, and Sariputta who is answering the questions. Okay, so Mahakotita says to the Venerable Sariputta, "What can be known by purified mind consciousness released from the five faculties?" Okay, so as you know, from previous discussions, there are six faculties. There are the five physical sense faculties, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. And then there is the mind faculty, or mind base. And then arising on the basis of each of these sense faculties, there's a corresponding type of consciousness. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose, tongue, body consciousness. Then the manovijnana, the mind consciousness. And so now he's asking what can be known by the purified mind consciousness, which is released from or disconnected from the five faculties. Now, there's many things that can be known by mind consciousness apart from the five sense faculties. For example, the square root of 25. To determine the square root of 25, we don't lay out 25 apples and then how do you get the square root of 25 apples? You figure it out mentally before you divide the apples up. And so that can be known, I would say that can be known by the mind consciousness apart from the five sense faculties. But here the text says specifically what can be known by the purified mind consciousness. So this would have to be understood as a mind consciousness which has been purified through a process of mental training, especially training in the practice of samadhi or concentration. And according to the commentary, sometimes I don't agree with the commentaries, and this is one of those places, it says that what is meant by the purified mind consciousness is the consciousness in the consciousness of the fourth jhanic attainment. And the reason, it says, is that the fourth jhanic consciousness can then go on to know the base of infinite space, the base of infinite consciousness, and so on. But it seems to me that the commentary is being too specific, too narrow and too specific. So I would take this in a broader sense. When the mind consciousness is purified by being detached from, you know, grosser sense objects and even from the subtle forms that are perceived in the jhana, what can be known by that purified mind consciousness of samadhi? And even in the fourth jhana, though the mind is not functioning through the eye consciousness and it's not seeing, you know, concrete visible forms, but still it said that in the jhanic attainments, the mind takes as its object some kind of form. It's not an outer form, but it's an inwardly visualized form, like taking the form of a bright light, a sphere of light, a colored sphere. So in a way, that's not a completely purified mind consciousness because it's still related to some kind of form, even though it's not a visible form seen through the eyes. But when one passes from the fourth jhana to the formless meditative attainments, then one casts away, or one leaves behind, even those that subtle, inwardly visualized form that's the object of the jhana consciousness. And so the answer is given that by the purified mind consciousness released from the five faculties, the base of infinite space can be known. Thus, space is infinite. The base of infinite consciousness can be known. Thus, consciousness is infinite. And the base of nothingness can be known. Thus, there is nothing. Okay, how does one pass from the fourth jhana to the base of infinite space, the consciousness of the base of infinite space? Okay, this is the way it's explained in texts, the meditation manuals like the Visuddhimagga. Okay, the jhanic attainments take as their object this very subtle inwardly visualized form that is called, the word used is the counterpart sign. In Pali it's called the Patibhaga Nimitta. So it's a kind of inwardly visualized form. Okay, now after attaining each jhana, each meditative absorption, the meditator has to acquire mastery over it. And one of the ways of acquiring mastery is to be able to take the Patibhaga Nimitta, the sign, this visualized object, and expand and contract its size, to extend it, contract it, extend it, contract it. Okay, so this is done through for each of the jhanas. Now when the meditator reaches the fourth jhana and wishes to go beyond to the formless attainments, they take the object. Let's assume it's a blue colored disc. And one will extend that colored disc, keep on expanding it, expanding it, expanding it, until one can get the blue colored form to spread out as far as throughout the entire inwardly visualized or the inward field of vision. So the inward field of vision is completely covered over by this blue form. And so it seems as though the blue of the sign, of the nimitta, is covering all of space. Okay, now to pass further, what the meditator has to do is to drop the blue form, to sort of peel it away. It's like when you have, is it called the decal? The kind of thing you put on the back window of the car to show who you're voting for or what cause you support. When you get it in the mail, it has this plastic covering, and then you peel away that plastic covering, and then the gluey surface is exposed, and you put it on the window. And so what one does is mentally one peels away that blue form, which is covering all of space. And when the blue form is completely peeled away, what is left? No, something is left. What? It's not that there's another it's not that there's another colored layer underneath that. The blue form is covering all of space. You pull it away, what is left? Exactly. The space is still there. It's like when I drink all of the tea in this cup, I say, what is left in the cup? You can't say nothing is there. The space is still there. Okay, so when one pulls away that subtle form, what is left is infinite space. And with that, the consciousness is then moved from the fourth jhana to the base of infinite space. And that is the object, the infinite space is the object of the consciousness of the base of infinite space. Okay, then to go one stage further, to go from the base of infinite space to the base of infinite consciousness, again, this is according to the explanation of the Visuddhimagga, the meditator then focuses, okay, now we have infinite space, and the mind is now focused on or contemplating or aware of infinite space. But now what the meditator can do, after mastering the base of infinite space, the meditator turns the beam of attention back from the infinite space to the consciousness that was aware of infinite space. You know, because when one is aware of infinite space, one is aware of it with consciousness. And so instead of letting the attention focus on this kind of outer object, infinite space, one bends the beam of awareness back on itself to be aware of consciousness that was aware of infinite space. And since consciousness was aware of infinite space, that means that the consciousness was infinite. And so one becomes aware of what is called the infinity of consciousness. And so that meditative attainment is called the attainment of the base of infinite consciousness. Okay, then to go to the third level, or the third stage, the third attainment, the base of nothingness, again, according to the explanation of Visuddhimagga, what the meditator does is to focus upon, instead of focusing upon the awareness aspect of consciousness, what the meditator focuses upon is the aspect in that infinite consciousness of there being no obstruction, no impediment, of that consciousness being able to pervade everything without any obstruction or impediment. Or maybe we could say focusing upon the non-tangible aspect of that consciousness, or the non-concrete aspect of that consciousness. And that is what is meant by nothingness, which doesn't really mean that the word nothingness is a little bit misleading in that it suggests, well, it suggests complete nothingness. But it's not that there's absolutely nothing, but it's focusing upon what I call the unobstructed nature, or the unimpeded nature, or the non-concrete nature of that infinite consciousness. And then when the meditator brings that unobstructed, unimpeded, or non-concrete aspect of infinite consciousness into focus, and then fully absorbs the mind into the non-obstructedness or unimpededness rather than the aspect of awareness, that becomes the attainment of the base of nothingness, what is called the base of nothingness. And these three attainments, maybe the description of them sounds very lofty, very exalted, very mystical, but I have to emphasize that for Buddhism, these are not attainments achieved through wisdom. These are not the higher realizations of the Buddha Dharma. But these are simply stages of meditative absorption, or we could say stages in the unification of the mind. Technically, they are all mundane achievements, worldly achievements. And they were not in any way the unique discovery of the Buddha. They are not unique to the Buddha's teaching. And before the Buddha attained his Sambodhi, his enlightenment, when he was learning or studying under the two Indian meditation masters, under the first of the meditation masters, he learned the base of nothingness. And then he gave that up and left that teacher because he realized that on its own, this attainment doesn't lead to enlightenment. And then he went and studied under another meditation teacher who taught him the fourth formless or non-material meditation, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And the Bodhisattva mastered that, and again he gave that up because he saw that it doesn't lead, that on its own it doesn't lead to liberation. Okay, now if you notice this answer that Sariputta gives mentions only three out of the four formless meditations. It doesn't mention the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Does anybody know why that is the case? Speaking about the base of infinite space, I can't create enough space to pour. Okay. I don't need infinite space, just enough to pour some of the tea. Okay, why isn't the fourth meditative attainment mentioned? Right, exactly. It can be known, of course, but it's said to be too subtle or too, use the word delicate,
yeah,
or maybe subtle or refined to be known analytically and to be used as a base for developing insight wisdom. You see, in the Buddha's method of training, of mental training, the Buddha, he didn't completely reject the formless meditative attainments, because he saw that they could be useful, it's just that on their own, they're insufficient. But what he did is to show that one could take these meditative attainments and then use them first as a platform for strengthening the power of samadhi or concentration, but then one could also use them as objects to investigate with wisdom. And one investigates them by wisdom, by turning the attention to them and seeing that each of these attainments is actually a mental, conglomerate of mental factors, an amalgamation of mental factors. And one dissects or analyzes those mental attainments into their constituent factors. For example, one discerns what is the feeling there, the perception, the volition, the attention, the mindfulness, one-pointedness of mind, and all of the other mental factors that are present. And then one observes how each of those attainments, with all of their constituent factors, is subject to constant arising and passing away, arising and passing away. And so in this way, one gains insight based on those meditative attainments. But this can be done on the basis of the first three formless meditations. But the fourth one, called the base of neither perception nor non-perception, is said to be so subtle, so refined, so delicate that the mind just can't penetrate it with wisdom, can't, you know, dissect it into its constituent factors. But it's said that only a fully enlightened Buddha can do that. But even a disciple like Sariputta, who is the foremost in wisdom, even he could not do that. Okay, so, I mean, people like Sariputta, they could attain the fourth formless meditation. But when they attain it, they emerge from it, and they can look back, and they know that they were in that attainment, but they're not able to dissect it into its constituent factors. And I think this is the reason why the next question is brought up. With what does one understand a state that can be known? Okay, one understands a state that can be known with the eye of wisdom. So the eye of wisdom, this is really just wisdom itself, which is spoken of metaphorically as an eye, because the eyes have the function of seeing, and wisdom metaphorically has the function of seeing, of understanding the real nature of things. Okay, so with this question, the questionnaire is the series of questions has moved from the sphere of pure samadhi, now it's shifted over to the sphere of insight or wisdom. Okay, and now he asks, what is the purpose of wisdom? And then Sariputta answers, the purpose of wisdom is direct knowledge, the purpose is full understanding, the purpose is abandoning. Excuse me?
Abandoning.
Yeah, I'll explain it. I'll write first the Pali and then explain. Okay, we have these three terms which constitute a kind of sequence. We came across these terms, if they look familiar, it could be because we saw them fairly recently when we looked at, I think it was the second part of the second talk on the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, Sutta number one. So it seems that these terms, that they constitute a particular sequence in that abhinya, which is translated direct knowledge, this, the way the word is used in the suttas, is the knowledge that is acquired by all the noble disciples when they make the initial breakthrough to the truth of the Dhamma. So already abhinya is achieved even by the trainee, by the one who has reached the stage of stream enterer and is striving or cultivating the path in order to reach the final goal of the path, to reach arahatship. And so the way abhinya is used in the suttas, it would indicate the direct knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. And then the knowledges, all of the knowledges that follow from the Four Noble Truths. As I explained when we were discussing the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, this part, Nya, you see it's the same in the two words. It's from the verbal roots, Nya, or Sanskrit, Nya, which gives us the verb Janati. One knows. And so abhinya is a knowing, and then the prefix abhi can suggest a higher kind of knowing or a direct knowing. Or abhinya, the prefix abhinya suggests superiority and directness. Okay, and so abhinya is direct knowledge. And so the disciple, even at the stage of stream entry, directly knows the truth of suffering, directly knows the truth of its origin, its cessation, and the path to its cessation. Also, we could say the stream enterer directly knows, directly understands each of the factors of dependent origination. For example, understands old age and death, understands its origin, its cessation, and the way to its cessation. Okay, now the next word, parinya, also is based on the same verbal root, but it has a different prefix, pari. Pari suggests fullness, completeness. So that's why we translate parinya as full understanding. So first one gets abhinya, this direct knowledge or superior knowledge. Then one cultivates it. And as one cultivates abhinya, then the knowledge, the understanding, becomes deeper, clearer, and fuller until when it reaches its culmination, then it becomes parinya, full knowledge, full understanding. So this is what is achieved by the arahant. And so when the Buddha was under the Bodhi tree, at the first stage of his enlightenment, when he first came to see the Four Noble Truths, then he realized, with regard to the first noble truth, that this noble truth of suffering he said, parinyaya. That means this noble truth of suffering should be fully understood. But then, as he continued to cultivate under the Bodhi tree, to pursue, you know, his awakening knowledge, to pursue it to its completeness, at the end, then he At the end, he said that this noble truth of suffering, parinyata, that it has been fully understood. That means that by fulfilling the complete process of cultivating the Eightfold Path, now he has fully understood the nature of the five aggregates, the truth of dukkha, of suffering. Okay, so one cultivates panya or wisdom in order first to reach abhinya, this direct knowledge, direct understanding. And then one continues to cultivate panya, wisdom, in order to reach full understanding. Then the third purpose mentioned here is abandoning, that is pahana. And what does the abandoning mean here? Abandoning of what?
Craving.
Not only, well, craving, but not only, broader term.
The defilements?
Yeah, exactly. To abandon the defilements, to abandon greed, hatred, delusion, to abandon the 10 fetters, the 7 latent tendencies, the 4 or the 3 asavas, or craving. Okay, we'll go through the next section, then I'll ask whether there's any questions. Okay, now Mahakotita asks, how many conditions are there for the arising of right view? It might seem that this question is disconnected from the previous ones, but actually what is called panya or wisdom is technically, it can be explained as right view. We can take right view to be the initial form of wisdom, of panya. But I think, according to the commentaries, what is meant here by the arising of right view is the arising of the world-transcending right view, or the supramundane right view. This is the right view of the liberating Noble Eightfold Path, the world-transcending Noble Eightfold Path. You know, not just the right view of, you know, our conceptual understanding through studying the Dhamma, listening to discourses, though also I think it works for that as well. Okay, anyway, Sariputta gives as the answer, he says, that there are 2 conditions for the arising of right view. One is called parato gosa, which means, it's translated, the voice of another. And the second condition is yoniso manasikara, which is wise attention. And it's said that these 2 conditions hold for everybody except the Buddha. And not only the perfectly enlightened Buddha, but also what are called the Pacheka Buddhas. The Pacheka Buddhas, does anybody not know what a Pacheka Buddha is? You never heard the term? Yeah, Pacheka Buddha are those, it's said that during periods when the Buddha's teaching is not available, There are some people who go off on their own and lead very rigorous ascetic lives, and on their own, without any exposure to the Buddha's Dharma, they achieve enlightenment. So sometimes Pacheka Buddha is translated as individual enlightened one, solitary enlightened one. Those in the text, they're sometimes shown as living together in small communities. So it's not completely solitary. But they're able to achieve enlightenment without depending on the teaching of the Buddha. And then the classic example of the need to depend on the voice of another is the story of Sariputta himself. Because Sariputta was, you know, we know that he became the Buddha's chief disciple in wisdom. So already as a youngster, he would have had very, very sharp potential faculty of wisdom. And on his own, he had engaged in deep contemplation before meeting the Buddha's teaching, and traveled all over India, visiting different spiritual masters, learning their teachings, practicing their teachings. And he would have probably engaged in a lot of deep contemplation and reflection, but still couldn't achieve the breakthrough. But then, one day when he was in the vicinity of Rajgir, Rajagaha, then he saw one monk, disciple of the Buddha, one of the first disciples of the Buddha, walking on his arms round, very mindfully, very peacefully. And when he saw him, he was immediately impressed and thought, ah, this monk must be one who knows. And so he waited till the monk completed his arms round. He followed the monk when he went for his meal. He got some water, served him with water, and waited patiently. And when the monk finished his meal, then he came up and said, I'm very impressed by you. I see you're very peaceful. You're doing everything very deliberately, mindfully, very calmly. Who is your teacher and what is the teaching that you're following? Okay, and then this monk, whose name was Asaji, said, my teacher is the sage from the Sakyan clan. We call the enlightened one the Buddha. And then Sariputta said, well, tell me his teaching. And the monk, who was very modest, he was not a very eloquent speaker, so he said, so he was an arahat already, but he said, you know, I've just recently become a monk under the Buddha. I'm not really very eloquent. I can't explain in great detail. You know, I'm just a simple monk. But Sariputta said, doesn't matter how much you can explain. Just tell me the essence. It's only the essence that I want. And then Asaji recited to him just a four-line stanza. Whatever phenomena there are that originate from a cause, the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, explains the cause, and also that which is their cessation. That is what the great ascetic teaches. And then as soon as Sariputta heard these four lines, he immediately achieved stream entry. Now, I just recited the four lines. Okay, maybe it'll work the second time. But let's see if we have any shop faculty and students here. Did anybody get it on the first time? Whatever phenomena there are that originate from a cause, the Tathagata, the Buddha, explains the cause, and also that which is their cessation. That is what the great ascetic teaches. Third time? Okay, so anyway, so this shows that even Sariputta depended upon the voice of another. And probably it was not just while he was listening, but his mind would have been working very quickly. And, you know, because we all hear the same words. He heard it in probably the language of Magadha, Magadhi. We hear it in English, but the meaning's the same. But he would have been, as soon as he heard the words, he would have used yoniso manasikara, reflected upon them quickly, but very, very clearly and extensively. And so right away there arose the path of stream entry. Okay, so we have these two conditions for the arising of right view. And so the way it normally works is that we hear what's called the voice of another. It can be the teaching from another. Nowadays, you know, if we read in books, it's similar to getting the voice of another. And then when we listen, then in order to gain right view, one has to reflect wisely on what one has heard. Just listening is not enough. Just memorizing what one has heard is not enough. Because right view is like a personal achievement. It's not just something that one can acquire by rote from others. But unless one is a bodhisattva in his last existence, on the verge of Buddhahood, or somebody on the verge of becoming a Pacheka Buddha, as important as wise attention is in order to achieve right view, this is the special right view of the Buddha's teaching, one has to hear the teaching from another. That's why it's said to be extremely important that the Dhamma continues to be proclaimed down the ages, through the ages. Okay, now we come to another question. By how many factors is right view assisted when, this is translated very literally, so it's a little awkward. First I'll read it and then I'll reformulate it. Okay, by how many factors is right view assisted when it has deliverance of mind for its fruit, deliverance of mind for its fruit and benefit, when it has deliverance by wisdom for its fruit, deliverance by wisdom for its fruit and benefit. Okay, what is meant here, the translation uses deliverance. This was Venerable Nyanamoli's choice, but now I would much prefer liberation. So there's two aspects of arhatship, often mentioned together in the text. Yeah, there are many kinds of liberation of mind. When we have liberation of mind mentioned, it doesn't necessarily mean full liberation or final liberation. Liberation of mind could represent just a temporary attainment, like a state of meditative absorption, a samadhi. But to indicate that this is final liberation, the ultimate liberation, the two terms are joined, liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom. They're two ways of describing one. When they're joined together, that the two terms are describing one state or one attainment, which is the attainment of Arhat. And the process of development begins with and is guided by the arising of right view. This is the right view of the stream enterer. This is the right view that comes at the beginning of the really noble or world-transcending noble eightfold path. And so this is the right view that is really effectively equivalent to wisdom. And now he's asking, what are the factors, the other kinds of practices that are needed to assist right view, to help it grow and mature in order to culminate in the liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. Okay, then Sariputta answers, that right view is assisted by five factors. Let me rephrase this. In order for right view to culminate in liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom, it should be assisted by five factors, or there are five things that contribute to the maturation of right view, so the right view will blossom in this liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. So what are these five factors? So he mentions virtue or good conduct, wholesome conduct. Then learning or hearing. This is hearing the Dhamma. Because even though, say, a stream enterer has the right view, so technically, he doesn't really have to listen to the Dhamma anymore, because he has the essential insight into the truth of the teaching. But in order to expedite the development of wisdom, listening to the Dhamma can contribute to that speeding up the process of maturation. Okay, then discussion, which means discussion of the Dhamma, because there can still be points which are a little obscure or unclear, and so discussion can help to facilitate the development of right view. And then the two essential factors are serenity and insight. So serenity is concentration, the calming down of the mind, the unification of the mind. And so the unification of the mind is what facilitates the development of insight. And then there is insight, which would be the practice of insight meditation. So these two kinds of meditation, serenity meditation and insight meditation, both contribute in their different ways to the maturation of right view, so that will culminate in that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. Okay, maybe at this point I should ask whether there's any questions.
Did the monk who Rahantu was supposed to Sariputta, I still didn't understand that he got enlightened in just those four stanzas.
Sariputta then.
Is it similar in meaning to what is similar in meaning to Anchavata Sankara Upadavaya Dhammano? Is it the same thing? Anchavata Sankara Upadavaya Dhammano?
It's somewhat similar.
That I understand. Yeah. But this thing that, as you said...
It's actually that maybe the difference is that Anicca Bhatta Sankara Upadavaya Dhammano. That verse pretty much just highlights impermanence. But it doesn't go into the aspect of causation, causality. Whereas the verse that Sariputta heard from Asaji, it says, whatever things there are that originate from a cause, the Tathagata has explained the cause and also their cessation. So it's dealing with what is the cause for things to arise, what is the cause for things to cease. Yeah, so it seems to be pointing not only simply to impermanence, but also to dependent origination.
Thank you.
Pante, when they refer to the voice of another, is that specifically the voice of an arahant? Or
it doesn't. The text itself doesn't specify any further. I would say probably it doesn't have to be that. I'm just trying to think whether if there could be somebody who's been meditating a long time and then a parrot comes by, who had heard a monk reciting the suttas, and then parrot goes, sabbe sankara nicca, sabbe sankara nicca. And then person, the ascetic who's been meditating, hears the parrot saying, everything is impermanent, everything's impermanent. And then he came to enlightenment. Possible, I don't know. Any questions? Then shall we go on? Okay, so now we come to the next section. Again, it seems as though there's a shift in the topic. So now, Mahakotita asks, how many kinds of being are there? Again, I don't like the use of being for bhava. I prefer existence, since existence can suggest something more concrete. Okay, so that there are these three kinds of being, or three kinds of existence. What are the three? Sense-sphere existence, fine material existence, and immaterial existence. Other renderings that might be used would be desire realm existence, form realm existence, formless realm existence. They're both they're just two different translations of the same terms. Okay, so sense sphere existence. This is existence. We have the basic Buddhist cosmology of the three realms. So we have the sensuous realm, sense realm, sensory realm, includes the human realm, and then the realms below the human realm, the hell realms, the animal realm, and the realm of the pretas, the afflicted spirits, sometimes called the hungry ghosts. And then above the human realm, we have, still within the sense sphere, we have the six desire realm or sense realm heavenly heavens. So those are the heavens of sensual delight. And then we have the fine material or form realm. This is the realm of, let's say it's a very refined realm of existence in which matter is still present, but only the subtle forms of matter remain there. The coarser kinds of matter have vanished. So these are the realms that are inhabited by the beings. They're called Brahmas, or we call them divine beings. And then above the form realm, or the fine material realm, is the formless realm, or immaterial realm. And this is a realm in which matter is completely absent, in which there's only the beings who exist there consist entirely or solely of mind, no physical bodies. And we have four basic levels within the formless realm. That is the sphere of infinite space, the sphere of infinite consciousness, the sphere of nothingness, the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. And so if we wanted to visualize this, okay, so we have the sensory realm, sense sphere realm, in which we can just divide it broadly into the bad destinations, which is the hells, the animal realm, the realm of the pretas, the good destinations, which is the human realm, and the sense sphere heavens. Then the form realm, or fine material realm, consists of something like 16 levels of heavenly, they called heavenly worlds. Then above the form realm is the formless realm, which consists of the four formless spheres of existence. And existence into each of these realms comes about through its own appropriate karma. So the karma that leads to the bad destinations would be unwholesome karma. To the good destination would be limited type of wholesome karma. To the form realm, it would be the jhanas, And to the formless realm, it would be the formless meditative attainments. So we could say that for Buddhism, all of the different realms of sentient existence are reflections or responses to the karma that living beings create. Repeat that? Okay, we can say for Buddhism, all of the different realms that sentient beings inhabit are reflections of the karma that they create, or they're sort of responses to the karma that they create. So the reason why we live in the human realm and perceive this world, the world as the human realm, is because we have created karma that has brought us into the human realm. And we share this realm with the animals, and the animals see the same thing that we do. Though, of course, they perceive it differently. Like if I don't have a cat, but if I had a cat and I left this book around, I wouldn't expect to see the come home one day and to see the cat poring over the book. But rather, if it was a kitten, it would be tearing up the book, the scratching. And then if we were to do like really wholesome, very strong wholesome karma, then when we pass away, then the world that would manifest to us might be one of the heavenly worlds. And if we were to achieve and master one of the jhanas, then the world that will manifest will be one of these heavens from the form realm. So the realm manifests in response to the consciousness, the basic level of the consciousness. Okay, now, so those are the three realms of existence. And then Mahakotita asks, how is renewal of being in the future generated? In other words, what is it that produces new existence into any of these three realms of existence? Okay, and then Sariputta answers, he says, renewal of being in the future, or future renewed existence, is produced through the delighting in this and that on the part of beings who are hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Okay, so what this statement is saying, sort of when we break it down, is that what underlies this entire process of karma producing new existence into any of the three realms is ignorance, and craving. So ignorance means not understanding things as they really are, not seeing the true nature of things. And when one doesn't see things as they truly are, then one gives rise to craving. Craving for enjoyment, craving for any of the objects of craving, whether sensual pleasures, power, privilege, fame. And then through that craving, one goes on delighting in one thing or another, or seeking delight in one thing or another. And that craving will continue based on this physical body as long as one lives. But when one dies, as long as there's ignorance there, one hasn't understood the nature of things, and this craving is still present when one dies, but the physical body can't support that craving anymore. But there's still the craving for more enjoyment, to to delight in this and that. So what happens? It's not the case that when the body dies, everything comes to an end. Just nothingness after death. But there's still that desire to go on enjoying this and that. And that desire, that craving, will bring about the creation of a new existence. So it brings into being, let's say, the craving drives the stream of consciousness into a new mode of existence. And the new mode of existence that the stream of consciousness acquires will be determined by the karmic dispositions that one has created through one's actions in this life. Okay, and so how does one gain liberation from this entire cycle of birth and death, this continuous, unbroken stream of becoming? That is what is asked by the next question. Okay, so how is renewal of existence in the future not generated? And then the answer is given, with the fading away of ignorance, with the arising of true knowledge, with the cessation of craving, then there is no generation of new existence in the future. So in other words, the key sort of to stop the process of interminable, endless becoming is to generate or give rise to true knowledge, to profound understanding of the nature of things. And when this knowledge arises, then it abandons or eradicates the defilements, and it causes craving to fall away. And then with the falling away of craving, the cessation of craving, then there is no delighting in this and that. And when there's no delighting in this and that, then the process of becoming comes to an end.
So from those terms, you're talking about like delighting in ways that continues the craving.
Yeah. I'm not saying that, you know, all delight itself is to be rejected. Okay, any questions? Somebody in the back? Oh, I see, I thought that Sandy was in the back.
It's very simple, but
they refer to sentient beings. That would be once in the sensual.
Once what?
Once in the sensual. Beings in the sensor.
Yeah.
Sentient beings.
No, sentient beings are in all three realms.
All these two realms?
Yeah. Sentient means conscious. Okay.
So not only the ones in the...
Not only the ones in the sense sphere.
Thank you.
Even the beings in the formless realm, so they don't have physical bodies, they just have, you know, consciousness of mind. But they are considered sentient beings.
I have a small question.
But
So this is a question that many people ask me, so I also like to know what you think about it. People ask me how significant or essential it is to believe in these realms of existence and rebirth in order to practice the path.
In order to
practice the path towards...
To practice the path.
Yeah. Is it something that you have to just believe, or...
That's a good question. What I say is that You know, Buddhism is not a system that requires dogmatic beliefs where you say, you have to believe this, you have to believe that. And one could undertake the practices if one finds the teaching to be beneficial to oneself, beneficial to others. One could undertake the practices and benefit from them. So if one wants just to keep one's practice of Buddhism at that level, that's all right. I wouldn't condemn anybody who takes that approach. But what I would say is that if one then takes the position that this is real Buddhism, that is something entirely visible here and now, and has nothing to do with other realms of existence, other lives, then I would say that one is developing a rather short-sighted perspective on the Dhamma. That there are many things that the Buddha himself would have known through direct knowledge, through direct insight, and that the great disciples knew through direct insight, and even great meditation masters today know through the direct insight, including the existence of other realms and the operation of the law of karma. And this is what provides what I would call the deeper and wider background to the practice of the teaching. So if one wants to practice just with the view in mind of the benefits that come from the present life, then I say just put the teachings one can't accept to the side and focus on what one can accept. But also, if one really wants to get the full comprehensive understanding of how the teaching works and what its original aim is and what its ultimate aim is, then one should take account of these other teachings. And I use, maybe some of my regular students are tired of the simile, but I use this example of, especially with the younger people who have the electronic equipment, you know, they're sitting there checking their emails coming, maybe they're getting emails coming from Taiwan or from Malaysia, India, sitting in this room in New York State, saying, but I don't believe that ancient Indian mythology about karma and rebirth. But here they're checking on their mobile devices, emails coming from the other side of the world with no wires attached to their devices. The messages are just coming through the air into their little devices. Maybe they have a storage capacity of maybe millions of emails stored up in their little device. And yet they're skeptical about teachings of other realms of existence and a law of karma which is so sensible. So you could just, if somebody expresses doubt, ask them if they're using a mobile device to get their emails. And if they say that, if they're your friends in Bangladesh writing in Bengali, and you ask them, where was their mobile device made? Maybe China. How can a mobile device made in China understand emails written in Bengali?
Mentioned about this hungry ghost and Bhagavan, they're saying this is not Buddhism. I say, no, this is part of Buddhism. The ultimate reality is ultimate reality, when you think of it.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, going to Nibbana, that may not be as essential to attain Nibbana. But the Dhamma is supposed to be the ultimate reality. So if there are hungry ghosts or other people as well, it's fine. You cannot change it just because other people don't agree with you.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I feel like this, you know?
Yeah.
There's some people, especially in the Western world, they only won't accept what science accepts, nothing else.
Yeah, so, I mean, one could understand that, because one wants to understand what could be verified.
But that may not be the ultimate reality in the universe.
Yeah. Is there somebody named Alan Wallace? Do you know Alan Wallace? He's written, because he's done, he started out actually as a, he was a monk in the Tibetan tradition, very knowledgeable. Then he disrobed many years ago, and then he went to university and he did his work, his undergraduate work in quantum physics. And now he's written a lot on the interface between science and Buddhism. And he is like a staunch advocate of all of like the traditional Buddhist cosmological doctrines. He goes farther than I can go. Like, I've had some correspondence with him where I'm playing the skeptic and he's defending even the Mount Meru-based cosmology, which I'm arguing against. But some of his books might be helped to deal with those kinds of questions. Wallace, W-A-L-L-A-C-E. Okay, I think if there's no questions right now, then we'll break. We'll take the lunch break now and then come back, say 12:15, to take any further questions. Okay, so we have the sheets for the sharing of the merits, so we're going to share the merits with the devas, the buddhas, or the fear spirits, the nagas, the dragon spirits, and with all sentient beings. Akasa ta chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa chiram rakantu sasana. Akasa ta chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa chiram rakantu desana. Akasa ta chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa chiram rakantu mam param. Etavata jampeyi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanam odantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata jampeyi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanam vodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata jampeyi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sadanam vodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Pavagupadaya avichihetato etantare satakaya papanna Rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha kamochantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, so we'll end with three half hours. I should, before we do, let's do this.
Bhagavad Gita.